it's become normal is we can read a little piece from this booklet we expect to come out this fall on preaching peace, justice, and care of the earth. From what must we be redeemed? The pericope from Malachi stops one verse short of letting us see the actual forms of unrighteous behavior that were in danger of judgment. Read further. Among the usual list of sins to be avoided, adultery, lying, sorcery, we find oppression of the laborer in the field, oppression of the widow and the orphan and the sojourner. They are listed as part of the particular evidence for the general charge of a lack of fear of the Lord of Israel. At the end of the 20th century, we, the church, find it easy to focus on the issues of personal morality raised by the prophets, chastity and sexual fidelity. After a relatively brief period of sexual revolution, we once again see them quite clearly as issues for us today. Unfortunately, much of our reclaimed morality is prompted by fear rather than by hope. But that is another topic. Maybe. As important as the personal issues are, we must not allow them to overshadow the issues of public morality raised by the prophets. The care of those who are unable to protect themselves or to find a redeemer in the culture. The redeemer, or the goel, bore many responsibilities in the span of the Hebrew texts. We are familiar with Boaz's role with Ruth and Naomi as a near kinsman who preserved both the land and the line of Elimelech's family. He protected the rights of two widows. He took on the obligation to preserve them, even though there was a nearer kinsman, one with greater legal responsibilities. The goel also provided blood vengeance for the victims of murder. Take note of Joab's willingness to defy his beloved king's covenant with Abner to avenge his own cousin's murder. The material world is not disjointed from the spiritual. The two are inseparable. Likewise, the public morality cannot be separated from the private morality. How we treat those under our authority or employ is indicative of all of our relationships, including our relationship with God. If we stand at the center of one relationship, it is likely that we stand at the center of the others. Malachi brings us both promise and warning in one sentence. The Redeemer is coming. Well, who needs redeeming, and from what do we need to be redeemed? Let's take a look at Malachi 3 and take some cues. Someone who was there, mind reading?
Chapter 3,
1 through 5, actually. I said 4, 1 through 5.
Behold, I send my messenger to prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver till they present right offerings to the Lord. Then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to the Lord as in the days of old and as in former years. Then I will draw near to you for judgment. I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, against those who swear falsely, against those who oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow and the orphan, against those who thrust aside the sojourner and do not fear me, says the Lord of hosts.
Thank you. Let me just remind you of a couple of things. If you turn the page, you may have to turn two pages in your Bible, you will cross that magic dividing line from Old to New Testament as it is set out in the Christian canon. I do not think that is accidental. I think the Christian canon is arranged the way it is in part to let us move from Malachi and these expectations of the arrival of first the messenger and then the Messiah, and then to set us at the footsteps of the genealogy of Jesus. Lay it right there in front of us. So those who set up the Christian canon put it together that way, so we would move from this promise of the arrival and this judgment and this freeing into to tell us, well, this is the one who's going to do it. Here he is. In the Hebrew canon, the Jewish canon, it's not set up that way. We end up with a different expectation. We end up with return from the exile at the end of the book of Chronicles. And so they're looking for a restoration of the physical kingdom rather than redemption through a new covenant. Just one of those, I think, interesting pieces of information, at least noteworthy pieces of information about how our Bible is set up and why it's set up that way. Some people think that this whole book is an extension of Zechariah. And the name Malachi, in verse 3:1 here, which says, "Behold, I send my messenger to prepare the way before me." Messenger is Malachi, or in English, Malachi. And that my messenger comes up several times in this book. And that's where the name comes from. We don't have, in the superscription we do have the word of the oracle of the Lord to Israel by Malachi, and then the note in my Bible, anyway, it says, or my messenger, my angel. But some people want to see this as an extension of a piece of Zechariah cut off in order to make 12 minor prophets, the book of the 12, because 11 wasn't a very special number to them. Just another piece of interesting information. Well, what's the promise here? What's about to happen?
The messenger's coming, isn't it?
The messenger's coming. And let me remind you that in most cases in the Hebrew Bible, the messenger and the ancient Near East in general, the messenger and the one who sends the message are pretty much inseparable. And that's why in the parable in the Gospels, where the vineyard dressers kill the messenger, that's such a great crime, because it's an act of aggression against the one who sends the message. And in fact, in this story, as we move down in this short piece here, as soon as the messenger finishes, "I will draw near. My messenger is coming." And then in 5, "Then I will draw near to you for judgment." So the messenger comes, and then comes the creator of the whole deal, which is a pretty interesting piece. But what is the creator coming for there in verse 5?
Redemption.
Well,
to judge.
Yeah, the text says, I think you're right. I think that this is part of redemption, but the text says for judgment. It's a word, it's a mixed word. It's a great Lutheran word of law and gospel at the same time. If you happen to be part of this list, and at the end, if you happen to be a widow or an orphan or a sojourner in this particular system, the fact that God is coming is really good news. If you happen to be one of those people who has been oppressing the widow, the orphan, the wage earner, or the sojourner, then this isn't such hot news.
What did they mean by a sorcerer?
A sorcerer?
Mm-hmm.
One who I think the chief sin here is the consultation of oracles, of divining both the future and interpreting the signs by means other than consultation with Yahweh, the God of Israel. What do you make of this list? We've started in on sorcerer already. What do you think is happening with this list? I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, against those who swear falsely, against those who oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow and the orphan, and those who thrust aside the sojourner. And do not fear me, says the Lord of hosts.
Probably the list of current social problems.
List of current social problems? Yes?
To me, in every case, like it's people, it's judgment against people who use or misuse other people.
Okay.
The sorcerer as opposed to the person who seeks to use sorcery, who thereby misleads.
Okay.
The adulterer who misuses the oppressor in every case.
Okay, so that's fairly similar comment. The social problems of the day, the scam artist and the abusers of the day. Was there a comment back here?
No, it's like it's getting ready to separate people. You talk about purifying and refining, so we're thinking, go to the frame between heaven and hell, perhaps.
Okay, so a division of the people based on what kinds of things they're doing?
Well, the pure
against
the unpure, or the clean.
Yeah. Are there any clean? Oh, I see. So this is the list of the people who are.
Right.
This
right.
is the dross, so to speak. The ones who won't remain. Yes.
Except for all the times in the Old Testament when it talks about the fear of the Lord, this says, do not fear me.
Mm-hmm. So.
So maybe he's talking to people who've already been refined. All after all of these people, but you don't have to fear them.
That's interesting. I hadn't considered that. Yeah.
In the context of coming to do refining, is it then not so much aimed against some of the people, but it's a coming to refine his people? And is everyone contaminated in some way with this? So everybody needs refining of his people, or is it just some who are in the group and because they. His people live with those some.
Yeah.
Some need to be dealt with.
Well, there in the list itself, there seem to be some people who are excluded from the judgment. In that, there are four classes here. The sojourner, going from back to front, the sojourner, the stranger in the land who doesn't have a foothold by owning property, by being part of Israel. The orphan, one who does not have a father or mother to protect, basically a father to protect his rights to lead him into, or her, but basically in this case, him into the mainstream of society. The widow who has no one to speak for her rights and is in danger of losing the family property. She didn't have, in most cases, most periods, seems not to have had property rights. And the wage earner, someone who had temporarily apparently given up the family land and had to work for someone else for his or her life, for his livelihood in this case. These people can't participate in these social ills apparently because they don't have enough power. I guess it is conceivable that one sojourner could oppress another based on the sojourner status, or a sojourner could oppress a widow based on her widow status. But it's not directed at the people who don't have access to power. So that's the only out I can see in this list in five. Yeah.
It also says it's against the sons or the descendants of Levi that were the priestly tribe.
Right.
They did not have land and so on. They lived among all, but they had the power.
They had incredible power through the practice of religion and the collection of basically the tithe, a sort of temple tax. So apparently the the problem was improper worship or a connection of the cult, an improper connection of the cult with the government, and to use it as sanctuary with the temporal things. And basically, we run the show as the Levites. And that became problematic in several instances because they ceased to be directors toward God and became directors of the daily life in a self-serving way. Many centuries before, but the classic example is the sons of Eli in the book of Samuel, who would take their portion of the offering first and then offer what was left to God. Real need and a very dramatic example of purification there. But again, that's from several centuries earlier. Do any of the things in this list remind you of another list?
The Ten Commandments.
The Ten Commandments. The false witness and the adultery right there in the list. And I think that while this probably is a list of what's going on in this particular period, late post-exilic period, that this is meant to remind them that, listen, all of the commandments are in jeopardy. You have broken all of them, not just these two. Maybe these two are particularly onerous in the day, but it tends to be that we tend to read the inclusion of part of a list as a reminder of the whole list in a situation like this. Which means that the people are forgetful of the whole covenant. And look, you can thank your fellow guest and staff members for pointing this out to me. I had missed the sorcerer part. And do not fear me, says the Lord, closing out the verse there as a summary. If you're practicing sorcery, if you are committing adultery, if you are lying, swearing falsely, if you oppress the hireling, the widow, the orphan, or thrust aside the sojourner, this is evidence that you don't fear me. And what your fellow classmate, so to speak, pointed out to me, that the practice of sorcery is in fact the heading up of that. One big way of worshiping other gods and not fearing the Lord is by practicing sorcery. So it's sort of an envelope. Those who follow other gods and therefore do these things, A, B, C, D, and prove that they don't fear me, you know, brings it around and closes it up again. Those who basically have other gods and therefore practice social ills, perpetrate social ills against their brother and sister. Any questions or comments?
They seem to have evolved escape clauses, perhaps, in the commandments. Because at the end of 2, I noticed there was, it says that you have wearied the Lord with your words by saying all who do evil are good in the eyes of the Lord, and he is pleased with them, sort of like rationalizing what's going on.
Yeah, I think this is fairly typical prophetic language. You see it in Amos, we see it in parts of Isaiah, to say you've perverted justice. You know, where is the God of justice is the comment here. He's not around. Not so much as escape clauses as turning back to them the way they have not done what they were supposed to do. They've not fulfilled the covenant. Which of these, or is any of these more important than the other?
Thank you. I would think that the sorcerers, because not believing in God or fearing God, would be the start of all the other.
Oppression, I mean, he could have just mentioned something about oppressing other people, but he gave his whole list, which makes me think that that was a very big problem.
Yeah. And I think both of your responses are absolutely correct. I think the sorcerer sort of starts off with listing, yeah, you don't believe in the one true God, and therefore you allow yourselves to do these things. And look how rampant it is. You know, over and over again in the literature, in the biblical literature, the widow and the orphan and the sojourner, the people outside, the people who don't have access to decision-making, basically, in our system, those who don't have the franchise, those who can't vote, can't give enough to their congressman or senator to make a difference in how they vote. Those are the ones who are outside of the system, don't have direct access to the decision making. That seems to be a real problem throughout the prophets. With in Malachi at the tail end of the prophets, says it's still a problem, and we're longing and we're waiting for the redemption from it. But it might be a surprise. the waiting for the redemption might be a surprise. You might find yourself on the short end of it. Well, what are the gods today?
Money and power.
Money and power.
Material.
Are those the things that keep us from taking care of the widow and the orphan?
Lust, greed.
Lust, greed. So adultery is still a problem.
Comfort and complacency.
Comfort and complacency, that sort of, I've got mine.
Yeah, it's a lot easier not to bother. Just to turn on the television and look at the things you want to look at, not to choose what you see in today's world.
So a lot of us are really filtered. So you're saying we don't even know that there really are widows and orphans and sojourners. In most cases, we don't know about refugees. As a matter of fact, only if we watch the right edition of the news do we see that we turned away another boatload of Haitians, or only when the influx is huge, as if the boat people from Southeast Asia 7-8 years ago, do we hear about it. Is anybody here from the Southwest? How much news do you even hear about people coming across the border illegally?
Quite a bit.
You hear a lot about it. How about people?
I think what's really happening, I'm not sure that we don't know about these things. The problems are so big that finally I say, there's really nothing I can do. Failing to see that I could help the neighbor, the one in the community, is a problem. Yes, we hear a lot about the aliens coming across at the border. Newspapers and television almost daily.
We live down there.
Yeah. Anybody from the Northeast? Midwest? How much do we hear about it in the Midwest in the newspapers?
We hear about the homeless people.
We hear about the homeless.
Yes.
But we don't hear anything about
Not too much.
Mexicans trying to get into this country for a better opportunity, or
there's some information coming through.
It doesn't affect you unless it's direct, you know. You don't have the same kind of effect about it. You just go about your daily life, you know.
There seems to be another emphasis to me we've been hearing a lot from the Pope lately too, about the emphasis is on I'm number one, and then after me, then maybe if there's time, I'll think about the widow and the orphan.
True. So we're not really co-inhabitants of this earth. We've got ourselves off and tiered off into unusually. Thank you very much. I'm at the top. Mm-hmm. I appreciate y'all doing that for me.
The other thing is structured that way, because it isn't easy to find opportunities to help, for instance, not easy to help people in Mexico without really searching for an outlet. For example, I noticed they sell them down in the bookstore. There's little bags from the Esperanza Co-op that say, what do they say, celebrate God's creation or something on them. And they're bags that you can mail order, and I just happened to read it in some church publication that you can mail order these bags from this co-op in Mexico, and it helps these women to improve their lives for their families. But the average person can't find that on a paint save.
Yeah.
Bags from Mexico, you know, an advertisement that's helping women improve their lives in Mexico. You can't get stuff like that. It's not readily available.
Well, how about one closer to home? I bet everybody in this room is related to a child somewhere. And I think our children are really being led astray in this country through television. There's too much violence, there's too much sex. The television executives are saying this doesn't really affect people watching this violence, which I think is the most illogical thing. If the advertising affects us, then the content of the programs must affect us equally. I fail to see their logic in saying, well, you know, it's just pretend or it reflects the society. But it's really damaging, and children are watching just tremendous amounts of television, much more probably than we did as children because but even the younger people here who watch, the programs were more innocuous. And I bet that if everybody in this room would take time to write a letter to somebody who sponsors a child's television program and say, look, this is really bad, I disapprove of this, I wish you'd put on Little House of the Prairie type things instead of shoot 'em up kinds of things, it would make a difference. And, you know, how easy, how hard is that? It would take 20 minutes and a 25-cent stamp.
But again, that's putting the responsibility on someone else when it should be the parent saying, no, you don't do that. And
I'm sorry, I disagree with that. I really disagree with that. I think children are society's problem.
If the parents did that, then the show wouldn't be on, because that is who they're targeting. If the parent, I'm a teacher, of course you can tell right away, and it's difficult for me to teach. It's difficult for me to teach sometimes because parents take how much responsibility? Zero. Oftentimes they take zero. I'm point in case. Towards the end of the year, we have conferences in my school for students who are near fail, in trouble. And I teach first grade, and I send out 7 slips for parents to come into the conference to talk about their child and to set up plans of how we can get this child to do better so they don't have to fail first grade. I sent 7 last year. I got 0 reply. 0 came in. 0 took responsibility. That, to me, I say, well, what the hell am I doing here?
That's what she's saying, that's society's responsibility, because we're always going to have irresponsible parents. That's true, but somewhere along the line we have to break that and all of us be interested in it.
Because if
are those kids that he just described, are they the orphans in our society?
Yeah, they
have no one to intervene in the system for them?
Including their parents. The parents aren't able. I've worked in daycare for a long time training teachers, and the teachers always come to me with the same thing you're saying. Well, if only the mothers were blah, blah, blah. And my response to them has always been, look, those mothers don't set out to raise rotten kids. Nobody brings a baby into the world and looks at it and says, now I'm going to bring you up to be the rottenest human being possible. No one does that. They do what they're able to do, and they aren't able to do anymore. They would. They really want the best for their children. They don't know how, or they themselves are so emotionally in need that they can't do it. And I always said to these teachers, give the kid what you can, because the mother isn't giving it. And she isn't able. And if you can give the mother something, give her something.
And sometimes the good choices are not that much in abundance either. You know, you may teach your child one way, but then the exposure the wrong way is so much out there to that it's...
Yeah, I don't think we can blame everything on the environment or society or, you know,
it's
it has
not
to be.
Simple problem.
And even the will.
But it's a lot of bad choices out there, really.
Oh, yeah.
and I, not enough concentration on the good choices.
Yeah, I don't want to dismiss the environment. I just, it seems to me that a lot of us, and I don't want to put it, I'm not using us as everybody except for the people in this room, although I know we don't do this.
No, we're Christian.
Run in and watch TV and say, you know, we made it through today, and boy, it's terrible out there, and we don't do very much to, you know, we're in some cases legitimately afraid to say to the teenagers on the street, go home, because we don't know what will happen. And but so we got to start it somewhere.
I do think the power of a letter is very powerful if it's a large number. It does speak.
Huge number.
It does speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we are, all of us, creators of that environment. I mean, we do have some power over the environment to some degree.
Make sure I come back to that, all right? I don't want to lose it. It's very important that we have some control. We create the environment, and I want us to talk about how the church creates an environment, or does the church create an environment? First of all, in the congregation, and then does the congregation have any influence on its neighborhood? But we'll come back to that after we get these couple of comments people have been waiting to make.
Sometimes I think that the geographical area is important because of getting the word out to the people. Now, we live in an area that's not too far from the Mexican border, and we go down with youth groups to take clothing to these children and orphans. And most people think of going over the border to Tijuana and all those lovely places are what Mexico is. But you go just a little farther into Tijuana, and the work there is just unbelievable. And so we have an opportunity to take care of these widows and these orphans more so than somebody that's living that's farther away from that.
Yeah, that's true of that particular example. But in Chicago, where I live, you can turn the corner, just like you can in Tijuana, you can turn the corner from big houses to literally turn the corner, and suddenly you're in an incredible slum.
So it's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
There was the gentleman in the blue shirt wanted to make comments that, think it's relevant anymore, or do you want to?
Well, yeah, I guess it was earlier, but I think it's a question of free will, because, you know, why is it more of a question than a comment, but in a way God puts the burden on the people who have choices, say, well, you know, the people with the money and the decisions, you know, if they don't treat these people right, you know, they're lost. Then we have the widows and the oppressed, and they're almost automatically included. You know, where is their, I mean, they have free will, they have choices in their life. I think we have to say that each one of us, you know, has to do good, no matter how little we have.
Absolutely. It really, when we fail to make the choices, when we fail to make those good choices, and allow, it's a lot cheaper to say a kind word to a kid that might change his direction. I don't think every kind word changes the direction of someone's life. I think it takes a lot of kind words in succession to get to build self-esteem, to get someone to be able to really do good hard work and not end up as a thug or on welfare or in prison, or just, you know, those are the gross examples, but there are an awful lot of people who have jobs who don't do any work, you know? And so they drag the system down too. It's all too easy to ignore that and just let people float along, people that we could otherwise make a difference in their lives. Now, how do we make a difference in lives? How do we, obviously I'm more interested in being redeemed from these social ills. I think bearing false witness and committing adultery are individual choices, which do affect the whole society. But I'm more interested in the individual choices that become much more quickly structural problems. Yeah.
I wonder if the key that doesn't start in the personal life. Whose life can I really change? But mine. And if I'm committing adultery, or if I'm telling lies, that has a tremendous effect on the person that I am and the focus of my life. And if I'm into that kind of thing, I'm not going to even notice the poor or the widow or anybody else. That may be going back to the sorcerer, that the one who simply survives by their own wits without any kind of spiritual sense of connectedness with God is the one that doesn't care. And whether I'm surviving, I'm going to survive the stock market today, you know, and that's my form of survival, which is economically way up here, or whether I'm going to survive my welfare check. If survival is all I'm about without any spiritual connectedness to God, then I'm not changing me.
Yeah.
And it's only as I change me that I can give to others.
Yeah. I agree. They're very much related. One we can all see, and I have no idea whether or not you're telling the truth about yourself or if you're faithful in your relationships. I do know if someone, I can very easily see if someone is outside of the power structure, and I can try to do something about that, to speak on their behalf. That's the difference that I'm trying to make, the distinction I'm trying to make here. I think they're very much connected, and I think you're right. When we don't have an internal gyroscope, don't have a relationship with God, then we're quite likely to ignore everything else. But let me get back to this comment here. At least I think I'm getting back to it. What do you expect from your pastors, from your bishop, and from yourselves in the community? What do you want them to do? We mentioned that the Levites are part of the problem here. They need to be purified too. What is your what are our expectations of pastors in the pulpit, of bishops, or whatever the equivalent of the bishop if you're not Lutheran or from an Episcopal system? Yes.
One of the things when I go to church, one of the things that it does for me, that I want it to do for me, is to help me kind of reorganize my priorities again, you know, focus back on what's really important and give me food for thought spiritually and help me center on that rather than all the day-to-day running and problems that you encounter in your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of get refocused.
So on the personal level, how to refocus and make priorities, maybe make priorities within the daily grind rather than instead of outside of the daily grind. What did you expect them to have that same influence on your neighborhood? Do you expect your pastor to have that same sort of influence on your neighborhood? Set neighborhood priorities?
I'd like to see that when the church is involved in, you know,
we're
trying to make a difference in the
neighborhood.
I think it does.
But that's the church and not the pastor. I think
he's part of that.
Right, right. But I think the pastor sets an example. He's also a regular guy with a regular grind and a car that breaks down and all these things. And if he can come through all of that and suggest to people who also have the same grind that there is something higher and there is something better. I think he can be a fine example to people who live across the alley from him, just the way that we should be. But that we are the church and not the guy that we hire to prepare a sermon. Mm-hmm. He also needs to be his own example to his own neighbors so that we can also see that as an example so that we can be to our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
To be like a leader and a teacher too.
To be like a leader and a teacher. Do you want your pastor to make public statements on public policy?
I think so. There's a need.
Well, I would like him to at least ferret out some of these opportunities for service, because most of us do get too busy in our daily grind.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe I don't know that it would help if I just took 15 minutes and sent a postcard to Sears Roebuck and say, I don't like you putting this kind of a program on for children. But if I knew that, I would do it.
So
I think that's the kind of things that pastors can do.
So you want her to put up a list that says, you know, these people will really listen to your letter. These people really need some blankets if you've got some extra
sure.
ones.
Bring people in for forums to, you know, educate us about these things, that's all.
I call it bringing up your awareness.
Yeah. And she does, too.
She does.
I would expect, I think this fits in with what we were saying, but I would expect the pastor to challenge the people in the congregation, but also encourage them. I mean, you can offer challenges, you know, whether it be encouraging people to get involved socially or, you know, improve their spiritual life or something. But at the same time, you have to be very encouraging, because people can get discouraged if the challenge, if they can't see how they can meet the challenge.
There are some incredible challenges out there, and as one of these gentlemen said, you know, I can't, I'm just one person. I can't do that. I can't feed all of these people.
But it was a widow who came with her penny and was the example to Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure that we've got to agree. I heard a couple people say that they want their pastors to make public statements. So I'm not, I've only heard that from a couple of people. So I'm going to sharpen it and see if I can't raise a few more eyebrows or hands at least. Do you want your bishop to put to make a have a press conference and make a statement about abortion? Let's say.
Depends what it is.
Yeah. Let's so I can see if I can divide the room here. Do you want your bishop to make a pro-choice statement? Now we've got a statement. We've got a statement coming to the ELCA convention this month, end of this month, for the first time. That's pretty wishy-washy, and it's so wishy-washy that nobody even attacked the substance except to say it's wishy-washy.
It's scary, I guess.
But do you want your bishop to make a pro-choice statement? Who wants to see their bishop make that kind of a statement? That's well thought out theologically. I know some of you probably think that can't happen.
I want to stick my hand up and say yes.
Yeah. Well thought out.
Because it depends on how you feel. You know, some are pro-choice and some are not.
All right. Let's finish the poll here. How many people do not want their bishop to make that pro-choice theological statement? So of those of you willing to vote, this is a pretty typically U.S. crowd. almost half of us voted. We're down the middle.
Well, I think part of the problem there is a lot of people haven't made up their mind how to vote yet on some of those issues. They're that tough.
Yeah, they are tough issues. Yeah.
I know how I vote, but I don't know that it's fair to ask the bishop to vote as I do, and I don't want him to vote the other side.
What he's saying, I agree with it. But if I don't agree with what he's saying, like she said, I don't know if I want him to say it.
So what are we going to? So the bishop makes this pro-choice statement. 4 years later, 3.5 years. I mean, and we always make these sorts of statements at the same time that we raise our salaries if we're elected officials, immediately after being elected. So 3.5 years later in the ELCA. He's up for re-election, and unfortunately, it's still always he in the ELCA. Do you vote, and you're a Synod Assembly delegate, do you vote against the bishop the next time around? Do you rally to vote this guy out, whoever made that statement?
You'd have to take the poll of your constituents, and you have to represent them if you were going to the Synod Convention, would you not? If you were representing your area and you were to go and vote, you'd have to see how your people felt and represent them, and that wouldn't necessarily be personal.
Well, Verlon exposed my Missouri Synod roots the other day, so I'll continue to fess up. And I don't think questions of morality are majority rules questions, are they? I mean, if you're convinced, and I don't remember whether you raised your hand at all or not, mm-hmm. but if you're convinced that for the church should not be making a public statement that's pro-choice, and your bishop does so, are you, and he's up for re-election, do you really think that's the way you should decide how you vote on that particular issue at Synod Convention on the bishop's fitness to lead as a moral leader?
I'd vote him out.
You'd vote him out.
We don't have an infallibility clause there, do we?
Not in our synod.
I think one of the problems with asking pastors and bishops and so on to make these public statements is that the way I feel is in the past they've been dealt with so harshly by the people who disagree, and it's been very cruel and ugly what's happened to them. So I'm kind of afraid to ask them to take their stand for the blood that will come after the fact.
Yeah. All right, so...
But are they taking it, is he taking it as a personal stand, or is he taking it as a stand for the entire church?
That's what I would like to see, is him say, okay, this is what backs me up on my view, and then kind of give some theological background for us to make decisions on. And then if he decides, whether he decides pro-choice or toward the pro-life movement, then say, okay, but this is what we can do to help change the situation. You know, a lot of people are having abortions, so let's get out there and help with education on birth control. And stop it.
And adoption.
Let's do more. Let's help. Let's
and supporting mothers.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Let's support the mothers who have these children. Let's put them in there. You know, let's
the pro-life people
up the adoption programs. Let's make it easier for people to adopt, easier for people to give their children to adopt.
Yeah, I live in just outside of Chicago now, but personally acquainted with George Clements, who's a Roman Catholic priest who started a parish adopted child, so that every parish has one adopted child, and he's adopted I think three or four sons by now. Which is, he had to go to the bishop to get permission the first time. After that, he stopped asking. I think because it took so long. But there are all sorts of things that can happen that don't look the way we expect the church to look. What Britt's comment about how harshly pastors have been treated when they have taken a stand, and then the subsequent comments about, I'd like to see the pastor make his or her personal statement and let us see what the rationale is, rather than speaking for the whole church, I think is an important distinction. But in fact, we do elect our bishops to a teaching function. We call our pastors to a teaching function, and they do have to, they are able, I believe, to make statements for the church, at least after all the bishops sit down together and make a decision. Unfortunately, they still vote on it, but then you've got 63 bishops, all relatively well-educated theologically, putting things together.
And in the healthcare system, I mean, on that kind of an issue, you'd like to see the people that are making the strong statements and they're helping some way to make it come about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know that people will back that up. They're happy to go out and pick it, but are they, you know, happy to go and help the pregnant woman who doesn't have any alternatives, that doesn't have any money?
Yeah.
And help her for the next 20 years while she tries to raise this child and brings it up with both sides.
Or help her make it.
She's like the parents he's describing.
I just want to point out the really difficult situation that we put our pastors in. Someone mentioned that the pastor has a grind just like everybody else. In some cases, the pastor has mortgage payments like everybody else. Certainly has car payments, kids' education is to think about. We want strong moral leaders, but boy, if they're strong moral leaders and they're not on the side that we're on, we blast away at them and we make it impossible for them to pay their bills. We say, go find another parish. Don't preach, you've gone beyond preaching and into meddling, pastor, so to speak.
That was my thought, was that how much do you want your bishops to be in the political process? You're trying to make them politicians rather than bishops, huh? Or encouraging them, really.
Yeah.
There's another way to deal with these issues, politically.
Well, in our system, we've got to put both of the systems next to each other. I mean, first, the bishops are involved in a political system after all, just in getting elected and the administration of the church. I mean, that is a government. Like it or not, we are an institution as the church, and that is an institution that they do. And if we're going to affect change in public policy, we don't have any choice in the states but to do it through the ballot, through the saying, hey, I represent so many votes. Listen to me when I talk to you. That's the way we've chosen to do it. I wonder if we couldn't go and say, I don't know how many of my people will follow me, but you know, this is the moral issue. This is the way I see it as a moral issue. I don't know if these people will even re-elect me after I've said this. And I don't really care. This is an important enough issue for me not to be re-elected on because I know I'm I believe that I'm right on this one.
I think that there's, at least in the Midwest, there's a distinction that wants to be made between being spiritual and being political. When you don't cross that line, that being spiritual means becoming political, that's taboo.
Yeah.
You don't take politics in into the pulpit. And that's, I hear that.
You agree with it, or you hear it?
I don't agree with it.
Yeah. I don't think. And see, well, there's certainly no Old Testament justification for it. We are stuck with those words from Jesus. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. But where did Caesar get his stuff from? The theology, as I understand it, says that it all belongs to God. Yes?
Well, it's impossible to go into the pulpit without taking your politics along. I mean, it's going to ooze out. I think the issue is, does the pastor go into the pulpit to use the pulpit to indoctrinate to his or her political point of view, or to raise the issues and bring his or her theological understanding and perspective of the scriptures to bear, and then let the people make their decision?
Well, what's the difference? Well, let me see if I can fuzzy it up some. Is it indoctrination or is it teaching to say the hungry have to be fed? You know, we throw away a lot of food and the hungry have to be fed. We need to make sure that these kids get fed. These kids that we've been talking about who aren't getting enough to eat.
But the political question is then, how do you do that? You know, do you give them food, or do you enable their parents to get jobs? Or, you know, do you throw it back in their laps and say, well, it's their fault, they should do it themselves, they do need to be fed, but, you know, I think
and
that's
and by George, we got to vote so-and-so out of office because this...
George, did you say?
This person does not represent, is not willing to stand up and do this.
Yeah, I think the line there is clear. When you start to say vote for so-and-so and vote for so-and-so, but the line is pretty fuzzy when it's, we need to feed these people. Mm-hmm. And that is clear, that's a clear biblical mandate. No question about it, it has to be done. Even if I don't say, this is what I'm doing, people probably know anyway. Some people are very threatened by that because they think, no, what I'm here for on Sunday morning is simply to be fed spiritually. That's the food that's important. You know, I'm from the Midwest, I hear a lot of that. I don't really want, that's not my concern, that's God's concern.
If you have a cold, you don't just take one medication and say, let it be. If this doesn't work, that's it. Most people don't. Most people will try anything that someone says will help. And I think if your philosophy is we have to feed these people, if that's what you hear coming from God, then that may entail a whole number of things. That may entail marching, protesting, soup kitchens, you know, feeding the people is the message you get, then, you know, or it may stop at one of those and that's it. But, you know, so that's what it seems to me.
Yeah.
It would seem like as politics can't help but ooze a little out of a pastor, it seemed like it'd be pretty great if we in our politics had a little Christianity oozing out every so often.
Yeah.
Politics like who's? Jesse,
yours?
Or
yours.
You know,
yeah. Yeah, but that's a very good point. You know, take the two Jessies.
Yeah. Not George.
Yeah, you can take George, please. But take Jesse Helms and Jesse Jackson. They are two very devout men, one an ordained minister, the other a very devout man in his own way. You know, whose Christianity do you want oozing into politics? And that's Paul Hansen's point. We've got to make I think we have to acknowledge the fact that the church is a political institution, and be very conscious of what political statements we make by our presence on a corner. This congregation does or doesn't care about the kids in the neighborhood, does or doesn't care about the families in the neighborhood, does or doesn't care about the general moral climate of the community. And what is the statement that we make then, as once we say, yes, we do care, and we're going to say, do we say, a family has to look like this, mom, dad, and kids? Or can a family look like mom and kids, dad and kids, mom's kids and dad's kids? And there are lots of other options. We make a lot of assumptions, but I don't think we're yet thinking. There are lots of places that are thinking this through, and the people who tend to come up here are from congregations generally that are thinking about those questions. How do we make the place safe for people to express their opinions? How do we make the place vital for people? How do we teach people how to be servants as well as leaders?
I think if I'm going to say that the biggest fault that I feel that's happening in the congregation where I'm a member is the fact that we are, our number one concern is that we don't offend anybody, within or without.
Yeah. And you know, this is a really offensive book. If you stop to read it, it's really offensive. We talked about David yesterday. Jesus offended people right and left, and that's why they finally hung him up on the cross. Peter and John on trial because they turned the world upside down. That's the accusation made against them in Acts. They turned the world upside down. Christians were not good citizens. And I don't want to advocate anarchy. But I think we have to ask ourselves, we have assumed that good citizenship is parallel with Christianity. And I think we need to ask ourselves again, is that true? Do we need to be redeemed from our good citizenship? Thanks for your attention. And I will see those of you who choose to come on Friday. Tomorrow's study.
No.
There's text study tomorrow, so they'll look at the lesson for this coming Sunday. And then I'll be back on Friday and Saturday.